Boundaries, 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 boundaries. Hey, y'all, welcome back to Made It Out. Today is an exciting day because it is 6 months to the day since we launched Made It Out. Matilda and I are so grateful and so thankful for everyone who has watched and listened and helped us build this community. And as a small reminder, the number one way to help us keep bringing you content is to please leave us an Apple review so we can bring you more and more and more. The other reason why it's an exciting day is because it's the first episode of May, which is Mental Health Awareness Month. So to kick that off, I've asked my friend Jordan Werner to be here. She's an AMFT and an LGBTQ affirming therapist. And we're going to talk about borderline personality disorder and queer mental health. What type of therapy do you specialize in?
Well, I'll kind of give you the spiel that I give clients, like prospective clients. So when I describe it, I describe like three parts. Like, so first I talk about LGBT affirmative. So LGBT affirmative is different than just being LGBT allied. It's like, I know about your experience. One, as a queer person, I have lived experience, but even if I wasn't queer, but I was trained in it, I'm kind of coming at it from that lens. I'm recognizing that your experience is different than that of a heterosexual or cisgender person.
Is that is that languaging very specific?
Yes.
For someone who's looking for a therapist,
yes,
allied and affirmative?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That is specific. And people don't really know that. Some people will say they're LGBT affirmative because they're actually an ally and they don't know the difference. Mm. So when I say to queer people, you're looking for a therapist and you want them to be LGBT affirmative, like really look for that and look for keywords in like someone's website and like an overall vibe, you know, get on the phone with them, like ask them specific questions. Mm-hmm. Because even as a queer person, I'm not an expert, right? Like I'm cisgender, you know, I'm not a gay man. Like I have deficits and blind spots like we all do. Mm-hmm. But I took certain classes and I've done, you know, on my own research and reading and stuff to make my work LGBT affirmative kind of one step more than just LGBT allied. And LGBT allied is important too, but mm-hmm. we also need people who kind of like are a little bit, you know a little bit more.
This is like a basic question, but what is different in the with queer people in our journey, like in our mental health journey? Maybe we could turn some light bulbs on.
So it's such a loaded question and such a like, there's no obviously black and white answer to that. I mean, the biggest thing is we're forced to hide and like what that does to your psyche. And even for people who come out at an early age, mm-hmm. we're just told that it's not right. Whether outwardly, like, you know, some people come from families where it's, you know, horrific. They're told like, you're going to get kicked out. You're going to get disowned. This is horrible. You're going to hell, like, you know, any number of things. And, you know, I didn't grow up in that type of family. I grew up in a very open and accepting family. And yet I still felt I had to hide because I learned from the world that it wasn't right.
Right.
You know, it would be weird. It's disgusting. You're a predator. Like I was in a sorority. So like, I don't know what that would have been like. I didn't come out when I was in my sorority. That would have been detrimental to my social life at the time. And I think that even if you don't have trauma, even if you don't have diagnosable mental health issues as a queer person, you're just growing up being told that you're not good enough, that you're not right, that you're not the same as everyone else, that you don't have rights, right? Like gay marriage became legal in all 50 states, like in our adult hood.
Right.
And I think it's just all this insidious kind of messaging that we're different in a not good way. Mm-hmm. And I think that affects us over time. It's like death by a million cuts. You know, some queer people have had like major trauma, some people haven't, and it's death by a million cuts no matter what. So we have to contend with that. We have to contend with the shame. We have to unpack all of that. And that takes a toll on your psyche, I think.
And what are some of the patterns that you see in queer people?
A lot of anxiety. Hmm. A lot of anxiety. A lot of not being good enough. I see that a lot. And a lot of shame in just all aspects of life. Like even clients I have that are like super out and like confident and that kind of thing, there's just so much shame and so much what do people think of me? And I think it all kind of ties back to identity stuff. And I think a lot of queer people struggle with, like, if I have this deficit, like, they might not think that consciously, but mm-hmm. if they're like, I have this deficit, I'm queer, I must be perfect in every other aspect of my life. Mm. I think that comes up a lot.
To, like, make up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's one piece. And mm-hmm. then the other piece is I'm trained foundationally. There's, like, three kind of levels. So I'm the first level trained in DBT, which is dialectical behavior therapy. It's really good for people who experience emotion dysregulation, like really intense emotions. Mm. It's really good for behavioral stuff. So, like, self-harm, suicidal ideation, addiction, things like that, eating disorders. So a dialectic in this context is two opposite things that can be true at the same time. So I always use the example, if you're in a fight with your partner, you're feeling, I love you and I'm mad at you. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world full of black and whites, and they're always, you know, society is, like, trying to push black and whites on us. Like, oh, this person hurt me, like, they're bad. This person did this, they're good. And all of us kind of struggle with black and white thinking. And dialectics help us to make space for the gray area and hold space for the gray area, which can be really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But that's really what we're feeling in the moment, right?
Right.
It also can be uncomfortable being mad at somebody that you love mm-hmm. and trying to contend with both of those things. So that's what I really like to use DBT for. And, like, I look through that lens for my own life too. And then the third thing is I really like to bring in society. Like, what has society taught us? How has it influenced our thoughts and feelings and behaviors that we don't even realize? And what things can we let go and kind of look at? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, like, my three-pronged, like, spiel that I give clients.
I love it. What does a session look like? Because I've only done just regular talk therapy.
Yeah. So I right now do regular talk therapy.
Okay.
And I use a DBT-informed lens. So I'm bringing in tenets and, like, concepts from DBT to influence my work.
Got it. And what type of person is DBT good for?
So DBT was originally created for personality disorders. So borderline personality disorder specifically, and that's what I have experience working with. Now they realize that DBT is really great for all types of mental health issues, and I employ DBT, like, for all different things. But it was originally created for borderline personality disorder, and in my opinion, people who have borderline personality disorder would really benefit from DBT.
Got it. Can you explain borderline personality disorder?
Yes. Borderline personality disorder is an attachment injury. So, like, attachment trauma mm-hmm. mixed with emotional sensitivity or emotional vulnerability and inability to regulate emotions. So it's, like, a three-pronged kind of thing that is a perfect storm. We all have a certain level of emotional vulnerability. Like, some people are super sensitive. Some people are, you know, not sensitive to things. So, like, if you have, like, a third degree burn and mm-hmm. you go outside and the wind blows, that's going to affect someone with a burn a lot more than it would someone without a burn. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I think about emotional vulnerability. And we all fall on that spectrum somewhere. So we have that sensitivity. Something, you know, triggers us. Mm-hmm. And then we experience this, like, overwhelming feeling, you know, maybe it's anger, maybe it's sadness, whatever. And then we don't have the ability to cope. So we're going to lean on other things. And, you know, this is a human experience to some degree, but in someone with BPD, it's really extreme. And it's, like, interrupting their daily life. It's interrupting their relationships. You know, maybe they're self-harming, maybe they're drinking, maybe they have an eating disorder, maybe they can't keep a job, you know, and that's even a spectrum. It's a really elusive diagnosis. So mm-hmm. it's, like, hard to explain in really clear-cut terms.
So you have to have those two things and then plus some sort of attachment trauma?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. So that's the biological part. And then the social part is the attachment trauma. The social part is some sort of traumatic invalidation. So it can be something really severe, like the psychology community, we say, like, big T trauma, you know, like physical, sexual, emotional abuse, things like that. Parents who are addicts, they're in and out of the house. Your attachment is really unpredictable. Like mm-hmm. one day they love you, one day they don't, things like that. Or it can be really subtle. you know, day-to-day invalidation, like being dismissed by a parent. An example I like to give that kind of paints this picture is, say you have a mom and a kid, they're like shopping at a clothing store. The kid's like playing quietly with toys and the mom's shopping. And the kid comes up to the mom and is like, I want to leave, I'm tired. And the mom's like, okay, 10 more minutes. But then 20 minutes go by. Mm. The kid comes back and is like, you know, getting more agitated, like, I want to leave, I'm tired. And the mom's like, 10 more minutes. And same thing happens again. And then finally the kid has a full-blown tantrum. And then the mom's like, we're leaving, da 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 da, and like blames the kid for that emotional outburst. Mm-hmm. So a few things are happening in that instance. One is the kid is being invalid. Their feelings are being invalidated. They tried to communicate and they were dismissed.
Yeah.
And then another thing is they're confused by their own emotional experience because they were trying to communicate that they were tired. Then they had an outburst and then they got in trouble for that outburst. So they're like, should I be this upset? Like, I'm not really sure. So it sends miscommunication signals to the kid. So like that example by itself is not going to end up, you know, with something traumatic happening or like guaranteed personality disorder or whatever. But if that kid has the perfect storm and that kind of stuff is happening all the time, you know, that could happen.
Right.
As that kid gets older.
But it sounds like that example probably happens to every parent.
Yeah.
Like on a grand scale level. Yeah. So how many people actually do have borderline personality disorder?
You know, I don't know. I think it's really commonly misdiagnosed. It's really commonly misdiagnosed as other things because it can look like a lot of different things, you know, like especially if they're having behaviors with it, it can like go along with other stuff and it can look like other stuff. So mm-hmm. like it can look like bipolar. It can look like schizophrenia sometimes if it's really severe. It can look like just anxiety. It can look like just depression. Addiction can be mixed in. Eating disorders can be mixed in. So people get misdiagnosed. So they may maybe go their whole life getting like, I don't want to say the wrong type of treatment, but maybe not the best treatment for them. Mm-hmm. And also I think it's getting more, not popular, but like more talked about because of TikTok, like, which is like funny, but also a real thing. People are coming out on TikTok and talking about symptoms and people are seeing it and being like, oh, maybe that's me. Something else that happens too is people who suffer from BPD have difficulty tolerating distress, which then can lead to difficulty taking accountability, which can lead to defensiveness. So it can be really hard to talk to someone in your life that may have some of these symptoms because they might not receive it well.
Right.
So I think that's also why it can go under the radar. And it also for some reason, I mean, I guess I know the reasons, but it's really stigmatized. People don't want to be diagnosed with this. People don't want to talk about this. The general public is like, oh, they have BPD. They're psycho. They're crazy. They're an abuser. You know, people will say things like that. So I think people are really scared. So I think if they might know, oh, I might have some of these symptoms, they don't want to tell anyone because they're scared to get that diagnosis or scared for what that will mean.
Yeah. We've touched on it like here and there, but what are the symptoms?
Okay. So I brought a book with me. It's called I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, Understanding the Borderline Personality. So I think this is really great for like mental health professionals. It's really great for family and friends of someone who might be struggling with this. And it's really great for like someone with BPD themselves. So I want to give some examples and then we can kind of talk about like the diagnosable stuff.
Perfect.
So I'll just read from the book. So who are the borderline people one meets in everyday life? So she is Carlotta, a friend since grade school. Also, I'm just going to say these names are from the book. They're not real people. over a minor slight, she accuses you of stabbing her in the back and tells you that you were really never her friend at all. Weeks or months later, Carlotta calls back, congenial and blasé as if nothing happened between you. So that's a really common experience. Someone who is borderline, they are getting really disturbed over something that's seemingly small. And I want to be conscious how I say this. They are really feeling that amount of pain. Mm. I don't think it's fair to dismiss it as like, oh, it's no big deal. You know, like even though I might not think it's a big deal, to them, it really is. Mm. And like socially, it might not be a big deal. And that's why it causes problems, because they don't know how to regulate those feelings. Mm. But to them, it feels that bad, you know? So that's why they react that way, because mm-hmm. it feels that bad and they don't know how to cope. So like having something bad happen to them and them cutting that person out. And then, you know, in a couple of months, acting like nothing happened at all. Here's another one. He is Bob, a boss in your office. One day, Bob bestows glowing praise for your efforts in a routine assignment. Another day, he berates you for an insignificant error. At times, he is reserved and distant. Other times, he is suddenly and uproariously, quote, one of the boys. She is Arlene, your son's girlfriend. One week, she is the picture of preppy. The next, she is the epitome of punk. She breaks up with your son one night, only to return hours later, pledging endless devotion. If the people in these short profiles seem inconsistent, it should not be surprising. Inconsistency is the hallmark of BPD. Unable to tolerate paradox, those with borderline personality disorder are walking paradoxes, human catch-22s. Their inconstancy is a major reason why the mental health profession has had such difficulty defining a uniform set of criteria for the illness.
Hmm. I'm just trying to think, because that is, I feel like, that black and white thinking.
Yeah.
But everybody has that to some degree. So yeah. It's hard. How do you really characterize someone as BPD and not just...
Yeah. So I'll read you the, we're going to have the same thoughts after I read you these. These are like the diagnosable criteria from the DSM-5, which is what is the book that, you know, mental health professionals diagnose from. I want to make a note on diagnosis, though. Diagnosis is really controversial. I don't even know how I feel about it all the time. My feelings change. In the world we live in, we need diagnosis. That's how you get care. If you need accommodations in school, or you need a certain type of medication, or you need a certain type of doctor, you need a diagnosis to get those things. Mm-hmm. That's just the world we live in. So diagnosis is important in that way. Like, I use diagnosis to, one, advocate for my clients to get them the care that they need. And two, sometimes people feel really validated by diagnosis, and I kind of leave that up to the client. If a client wants to identify with a diagnosis, I'll use that language. If they don't want to, we don't have to use the diagnosis.
Right.
So I just want to say that, like, diagnosis is a sticky thing. And, you know, for anyone listening and watching this, just because you have these things doesn't mean you meet a diagnosis. You know, it's a lot, as we're talking about, like, nuanced.
Yeah.
It's a lot more nuanced than that. Okay, so 9 criteria. Frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. Unstable and intense interpersonal relationships, lack of clear sense of identity, impulsiveness in potentially self-damaging behaviors such as substance use, sex, shoplifting, reckless driving, binge eating, recurrent suicidal threats or gestures or self-mutilating behaviors, severe mood shifts and extreme reactivities to situational stresses, chronic feelings of emptiness, frequent and inappropriate displays of anger, and transient stress-related feelings of unreality or paranoia. And, you know, we can read those and be like, well, I feel every single one of those sometimes. Right? To one degree or another, we all struggle with the same issues as the borderline patient, which is what we've been talking about. The threat of separation, fear of rejection, confusion about identity, feelings of emptiness, and boredom. The discriminating factor, however, is that not all of us are controlled by the syndrome to the degree that it disrupts or rules our lives. So that's the difference.
Mm.
And that's really hard to pin down. And it's different in every person. Even if we lined up like 10 people that, you know, meet the diagnostic criteria for this and have been in treatment and all those things, it's all going to look different from person to person, which is like anything.
Other than the examples that you read in the book, when someone comes into your office, what are some of the signs maybe that they have?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, if I'm starting to think, oh, maybe this person has some personality traits, I'm looking at a few things. One is their relationships. Mm. If they're telling me, a theme can be like everybody in their life is wrong and they're always right. This person hurt me in this way. This person hurt me in this way. This person hurt me in this way. Like, it's kind of like this repetitive and it's always like the same story. And maybe they're like, and I don't know what happened. They just didn't want to be friends with me anymore. Or no. And I just thought, I don't need friends like that in my life. Another example could be like the person in your life who's anxiously attached to you or to someone you know. Like, are you mad at me? Are you mad at me? Are you mad at me? And you're like, no, I'm not mad at you. But now I'm mad at you because you won't stop bothering me about it. Mm-hmm. A phrase that I've heard that I really resonate with in explaining this is, someone with borderline personality disorder creates the abandonment that they fear.
Wow.
Which is like really profound to think about. And it's really heartbreaking too. Because mm-hmm. these people are in so much pain. And that's what I think that the general public doesn't realize. Because people who meet this criteria can also come off as abusive, emotionally abusive, mm-hmm. Because they are... they feel so dysregulated that the people in their life feel dysregulated. Mm. They're kind of projecting those feelings onto others.
Yeah.
And it can turn abusive sometimes. But I always like to really, really harp on the person who's doing that. They are in so much pain. And all they're trying to do is not feel pain anymore. And they don't have the skills to do it. Mm. And it's not to say that you know, someone who is in relationship with someone like this, it's not to say that you shouldn't set boundaries and you should just like withstand everything coming your way, but to be able to have empathy, you know, for people that are experiencing that, I think helps. Something else I wrote it down in my notes that I think describes someone that might be feeling this way is the acronym FOG, F-O-G, fear, obligation, and guilt. So people who might be struggling with a personality disorder are going to use these three things to emotionally blackmail people in their life. Mm. They might not even know they're doing it. Some people know they're doing it. Some people don't, but they use fear, they use obligation, and they use guilt because wow. they're so scared of that person leaving them. They're going to use every single tool to get them to stay. I like this kid's story. It's the sun and the wind, and they're having a competition to see if they can get this guy to take his jacket off. And the wind like makes a storm and is like blowing so hard. And the guy just keeps buttoning up his jacket really, really tight. And he's like not going to let his jacket come off because he's freezing. Mm-hmm. Then the sun comes in and like makes it really warm in springtime. And the guy takes off his jacket like within the first few minutes. That's kind of how I see it. Like wow. someone who wants something so badly that they use all the wrong ways to get it. And it ends up hurting them and the person that they love.
Wow. That example, I feel like could be applied to so many things.
I know so much stuff. I like to
that.
Use it.
That's so great. I'm wondering, because when I was younger, I really think that this could have been something in my life. Like,
yeah, maybe.
I really did struggle with binge eating. I had some crazy like attachment stuff, like so mm-hmm. such a bad fear of abandonment to where it would make me act so fucking mm-hmm. crazy. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of those things and I do feel like I was the extreme. I had a really hard time regulating my emotions. But what I wonder is like, can you come out of it? Cause I don't think I'm not that way anymore,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And I've only been in like regular talk therapy. So I just wonder what's the journey of someone with BPD?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in terms of like the mental health professional piece, we actually don't officially diagnose anyone under 18 with BPD because the symptoms can so look like just being a teenager. Mm. Like teenagers have, you know, raging hormones. So much is changing. You know, maybe they have trauma, all this stuff. So like a lot of times we don't want to make that formal diagnosis until they're a little bit older and they're, you know, some of that stuff has settled down. Mm-hmm. So part of it could have been that you were experiencing that. In terms of like recovering or like coming out of it, I would say like, yes, you can. There's plenty of clients that I've worked with, my colleagues have worked with, where they come into therapy, their lives are just burnt to the ground and they're miserable and they're in immense amounts of pain. And then at the end of therapy, you know, after, you know, maybe they do comprehensive DBT, maybe they work with you for a few years, they are no longer meeting criteria technically for this thing. Doesn't mean they're not always going to struggle with these things. I mean, I feel that way about anxiety. Like, I don't struggle with anxiety right now, but it's part of my life and I know it can come back at any time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there's a black and white answer. Mental health is just so interesting. It's not like physical illness, you know, it's more like chronic illness, I would say. But
I've
technically
never heard that. That's an interesting,
but technically, yes. Like if you get treatment and do the work, like you can come out of it. You can learn behaviors and coping skills and ways to regulate your emotions. That's the point of DBT. And also, it's not to say that not other types of therapy can help. Mm-hmm. There's tons of mental health care and like stuff that I believe that works for all different types of people. It's just if we're talking about like what the research shows, DBT works, mm-hmm. not to say other things don't work too.
Have you found that there's a correlation in queer people to BPD?
So this is like anecdotally in my life, because I don't know if there's any research about that. I think it makes sense that queer people might experience this more. Mm-hmm. And I would even venture to say marginalized communities more. People of color, queer people, including trans people, women, which I'm going to touch on that in a second. But because as I said before, traumatic invalidation is part of this. Mm. And just by existing as a marginalized person, you have traumatic invalidation. Mm-hmm. DBT was created in like the 70s or something, and it was created by a white woman. Her name's Marsha Linehan, and she actually suffers from BPD, and nothing was working for her. So she was like, I need to find something that works for me, and she created DBT. It pulls from other modalities. It pulls from Buddhism. It pulls from 12-step. It pulls from CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. And I don't want to ignore like the inherent like white supremacy and like privilege in this type of therapy. It's really expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, when it was researched, it was in the 70s. It was, of course, only researched on white people. So it doesn't take into account as much the traumatic invalidation that queer people and other marginalized groups have just by existing mm-hmm. In a white supremacist and patriarchal world. But yes, I think that it only makes sense to me that it would affect queer people because of the invalidation from society and then from the family. You know, if people have that type of family, it only makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But I want to be clear that I don't know if that's like proven.
Sure.
Or even has been studied.
And what were you referencing talking about women?
Oh, yes. Some people think that BPD is a patriarchal diagnosis that's given to women more often than men. I don't know if that's true. I don't know how I feel about that, because I do think that it is a real diagnosis and a real thing that people suffer from. And I don't want to invalidate the people that really suffer from this mm-hmm. by just saying, oh, it's a patriarchal thing. Everything has in our society has patriarchal beginnings and patriarchal and white supremacist undertone. So I don't disagree with it, but I don't fully agree with it either. When mental health care was becoming a thing, so like all the way back to Sigmund Freud, who also was controversial, women were experiencing crazy symptoms like headaches, hallucinations, crying spells, you know, like whatever. And they called it hysteria. Like that was mm-hmm. like a woman's diagnosis was hysteria. And Sigmund Freud, this is simplifying it, but discovered that if he sat down and talked to these women, their symptoms subsided because they were talking about their feelings. And that was like the birth of talk therapy. Mm. And a lot of those symptoms can be consistent with like a modern day BPD diagnosis. Wow. So like, does it have patriarchal beginnings? No doubt about it. Do I think it's like a fake diagnosis? I don't think so. I think it's real.
Wow. That is so interesting. How can someone who's in a relationship with or related to someone with BPD support that person and then also support themselves?
I think both people need to be in therapy. And I also think that boundaries. That is like the biggest thing that's going to help. It's going to help the person who's mm-hmm. suffering too. They might not feel that way in the moment, but boundaries are super important. Relationships are symbiotic, so these things don't happen in a vacuum. Like, yes, the person who has a diagnosis is coming to the table with more, maybe, but like relationships feed off of each other. So mm-hmm. there's going to be stuff that the partner or mom or boss or sibling or whoever or friend is reinforcing or enabling or, you know, feeding into the patterns of the person with a diagnosis, which is why I think both people need to be in therapy. Mm. When a family goes to comprehensive DBT, like say with a teen, the parents are required to be in therapy at the same practice and learn the same skills. Like, it's really a family affair.
Yeah.
whatever the family looks like, you know, partners, friends, siblings, whatever, kids. One thing I will teach you, and, you know, hopefully this can help someone, is when we feel really dysregulated, how do we calm ourselves down? So if we're measuring our distress from 0 to 10, this is for when our distress is 7 or above. This is something that is a really helpful skill. It's called the TIP skills, T-I-P-P. T stands for temperature. So what you're going to do is fill a bowl of ice water, put your face in the bowl of ice water.
Wow.
Up to like your temples, and hold your breath for like 20, 30 seconds, as long as you can stand it. Take your face out and repeat it like 2 times. Do it like 3 times. What that does is it activates what's called the dive reflex, which happens when we submerge ourselves in cold water, and it lowers your heart rate. So chemically actually activates your parasympathetic nervous system and calms you down.
Wow.
So that's one. I stands for intense exercise. So like 20 minutes of getting your heart rate up. Mm-hmm. Same thing. It helps to expel that extra energy. If you can't do 20 minutes, even doing like do 50 jumping jacks and 50 sit-ups, like, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. The first P stands for paced breathing. So this is like a breathing technique. It's kind of like boxed breathing. If you're familiar with box breathing, your out breath needs to be longer than your in breath. So you breathe in for like a count of 4, breathe out for like a count of 7, because breathing out actually activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which calms us down. Breathing in sends oxygen to your brain and gets us actually more charged. Mm. So when people are anxious and we say like, oh, take a deep breath, breathing in is actually not going to calm you down. It's the breathing out that's going to calm you down.
Wow.
And that's good, because if you're in a situation you can't leave and you need to calm down, like I say this to kids in school a lot, they can do the breathing in class without anyone noticing. Mm. So that is helpful. And then the second P is paired muscle relaxation, tightening and releasing your muscles in like a systematic way. So starting at your feet or your head and clenching the muscles for like 10 seconds and then releasing them and going all the way down.
Wow.
Or all the way up. So like pick one that works for you and use it. That can, when you're really angry, when you're really upset, this is like when you feel out of control, your emotions are in control, you're in the passenger seat. You feel like drinking and you're not supposed to. You feel like self-harming. You feel suicidal, like any of that stuff. Even if you're in a superheated argument with someone and you can't calm down, it's really good tools to use.
That is so helpful for all of us. I love that.
I know, after I remind myself to use them.
I had heard of the box.
Yeah.
Well, because I do yoga.
Yeah.
And so that was it. And I love box breathing.
Yeah.
Because it's in, up. You go in,
yeah, you up
and then
hold it and then let it out and then hold it. And
yeah,
it's similar.
Yeah.
So if that works for you, do that, you know, like it's just very similar.
Is the theory just the longer breath out and bringing awareness to the breath? Yeah, that makes sense. I love it. What do you suggest for someone who thinks they might be struggling with BPD?
Go to therapy, bottom line, but be careful. I suggest DBT. I'm not going to say that's like the end all be all, but I think DBT, because the thing about DBT is that therapist is going to understand what they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. The thing that happens is a lot of people with BPD will go to a therapist. The therapist doesn't pick up on it or has no experience through no fault of their own. The client doesn't know what they're dealing with. And then they end up in the same cycle relationally that they're in with every other person in their life. And the therapy is not helping.
Mm.
So I suggest DBT, someone who knows what they're dealing with. And if you don't know that you might have a personality disorder, but you're struggling with some of the things that we've talked about, go to DBT anyway. Like DBT is going to help you. And maybe you don't need comprehensive DBT. Maybe you just need a therapist, like someone like me that knows DBT, but isn't like practicing in that way anymore, which like I'll plug myself because I'm taking new clients. But go to someone who knows how to deal with this behavioral stuff. And obviously I'm biased because that's what I practice. But even if you don't have BPD, but you're struggling with binge eating or self-harm or tumultuous relationships or mood swings or whatever, DBT can help. Mm-hmm. So I think anyone that feels like they're feeling this way, look into DBT. The book that I brought today, I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, you know, read a book, see if you resonate with it, you know, listen to a podcast, like do some research if you want to just start out. But DBT is definitely the research-based gold standard treatment.
Got it. This isn't a trick question. I'm just curious for anybody who maybe can't afford therapy at the moment. Is there anything you could be doing on your own?
Yeah,
if you think you have it?
That's a good question. And it's really real. Mental health care is so expensive. You have to have some sort of privilege to access it, unfortunately. There is this one website. It's like a database. It's called Open Path Collective. It's a database or a directory of therapists, and you can filter it. You can say, like, you know, different things that you're looking for, whether it's the type of therapy, what you're suffering with, if you want a female therapist, male, non-binary, whatever. And the rates are $40 to $70 a session. Wow. So that's a really good place if you want therapy and you can't afford something. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good place to look. And this is my personal opinion, but 12-step is really similar to DBT.
Wow.
And I'm not saying for someone who's like not an addict to like go into like a 12-step community and like, you know, it's obviously a fine line. But 12-step is like, it's free and it employs a lot of some of the behavioral stuff that DBT does, and a lot of taking accountability, a lot of looking at your own part, how you can change your relationship, stuff like that. And, you know, there's a million 12-step fellowships. Like, it started from AA, but there's like Overeaters Anonymous and, you know, Debtors Anonymous and, you know, Sex and Love Addicts. Like, there's all different ones. Mm-hmm. 12-step has its own host of flaws. It's not a perfect program. I mean, I'm a member of 12-step for alcohol and drugs, and I love it. But I notice a lot of similarities. Mm. And so if someone, a lot of people who have personality traits are also struggling with substance use and other stuff, and maybe 12-step is a way for them to get some of that help that is free.
That's really great advice. Okay. Now I want to know, what are you working on in therapy?
Okay. So I've been with my therapist for as long as I've been with my fiance.
Wow. Which is a long time.
Yeah. 7 years.
Wow.
You know what? I work on, it's hard to say because I originally went to therapy for anxiety. So I was working a lot on like, you know, symptom management, like figuring out my anxiety because it was so acute. Mm-hmm. And now I'm not struggling with that as much. In the last 2 years, I've been sober almost 2 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I was working on sobriety a lot, mm-hmm. like with him and how that connects to like anxiety and my identity and all of that kind of stuff. Right now, I think, and this is a continuous thing, I'm working on a lot of, I think I'm working on black and white thinking. I will share a little bit about it. So like with everything that's been going on in the world the past, you know, 5 years or past since everything came to a head around COVID and Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. I have struggled a lot with, as I'm sure many of us have with loved ones having differing opinions mm-hmm. to me. And because of being a queer person and the people that I work with, my clients, who I'm very passionate and protective about, I am very quick to be like, well, fuck you. Like, you're this. So like, I don't want you to be in my life. Or like, I have a hard time like holding the nuances. I can hold so much nuance about so much stuff, but I really struggle with that because it feels so personal to me. Mm-hmm. So when people don't have the same social, political views as me, I'm really working on seeing all sides of the story mm-hmm. and understanding that like what people want is to be happy and like have a good life. And even if their views are different than mine, I think that maybe they're trying to get to the same goal as me, which is to just like feel good and be happy. At least I hope that's what people think.
Which is really hard because I moved from Texas for that exact reason.
Yeah.
And don't talk to most people from there for that reason. And it's hard to know where that line is, because at what point is it a self-protective thing? Like, I can't allow that in. Or I should allow that in to understand the nuances and maybe create change, or it's like hard to know.
Yeah. I think that that's It is really hard to know. And I think that that's a personal journey and a situational journey because sometimes it is just like you don't have to have certain people in your life. So it's definitely a balance of those two things. I think for my personal story, it's not so much about having people in my life, but my personal like views on people or personal feelings about them.
Mm-hmm.
Even like if I read something in the news, like instead of going to automatic rage and like hate, how can I like have empathy and compassion for someone else who I don't agree with? Like I maybe don't want that person close in my life, but I'm going to make space for them. And then also applying that to people who are in my life.
Right.
You know, who I don't want to cut out, but like I struggle with maybe they have differing opinions to me.
Yeah. Okay. We play our game. It's U-Haul, you ghost.
Okay.
No in between.
So U-Haul is like pick it. Mm-hmm. You ghost is like no.
Yeah.
Okay.
Full send or absolutely
okay,
not.
Okay. Got it.
And like they're perfect in every other way except for this one thing.
This is so perfect for DBT, talking about DBT, because DBT is about like not being black and white and like holding space for the gray area. And this is going to force me to do
that. We are not holding any space for gray here. Okay. Their formal attire is a cowboy hat and bolo tie.
U-Haul. Yeah.
If it's unironic.
U-Haul. Yeah.
Wow. It's triggering for me. I went
kind
to
of hot, no?
Not when it's done, not I, like. It's,
I didn't grow up in the South, so.
I went to prom with a guy in a cowboy hat and a bolo tie, and he was so fucking serious. So for me,
I'm kind of into that. Like, I think that's hot if they're not like a piece of shit. And like, if they don't have anything else like conservative and Southern about them, then U-Haul. But I'm doing the gray area again, so.
But chances are that's not the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, I mean, I'm going to stick with my original answer off the bat. Yeah.
All right. What about she runs a John Mayer fan account?
You ghost.
Same.
Yeah.
I do not like John Mayer.
I like will sing to daughters, but like, I don't know. He gives me some bad vibes sometimes.
Same. Yeah. Usually I'm the one in the room that people are like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You don't like John Mayer. But I feel, thank you for holding space for me.
Yeah, of course.
She can't find China on a map.
Oh, fuck. You ghost. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's bad. You're like, I don't know where China is.
This one was probably based on me. I will say, geography, not my best subject. Yeah.
But China, like, okay, smaller countries, fine. Not a big deal. But, like, that's...
I think I could find China on a map.
Yeah, because it speaks to, like, their overall intelligence, like, around, you know, in general.
You're right. Her favorite book is Britney Spears, The Woman in Me.
You ghost.
What if she's a big Britney Spears fan?
Favorite book?
I know. It's
like number
awful.
One. No. If it's her number one, no.
Yeah.
If it's like, oh, I loved it, fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah,
of
course.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Love, love, love this talk. Is there anything that you want to tell the listeners about?
Yes, I would like to tell the listeners to visit my website, which is in my Instagram bio, so you can find it there, and get a therapist if you can. If you can't get a therapist, talk to your friends, talk to your family, talk to people who have similar, you know, ideas to you, read things, research stuff, just like be introspective. I think that's where it all starts. I think that's it.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That's it.
That's China.
Oh, God. This one.
That's India. Oh. But that's close-ish.
Guys, I'm really bad at geography. I was looking at that picture
and was like, do I know which one it is?
Thank y'all for listening to today's episode. As always, help us spread the gay agenda by writing an Apple review, rating us on Spotify, and sharing it with everyone you've ever met. You can find today's guest at Instadub92, our show at Made It Out Podcast, and me at Mal Glowinki. Made It Out is produced and edited by Matilde Jordan and worked on solely by lesbians.
Paws on soft cushions, two hearts, whiskers intertwined, lesbo love feline.